Monday through Friday, the National Broadcasting Company brings you news and reviews by outstanding reporters. Tonight, we hear first from William Hillman, European director of Collier's Weekly, who speaks from London.
This is Bill Hillman speaking. A slim, youthful-looking figure in naval uniform, six rows of medals on his breast, rose in the House of Commons tonight and delivered a tremendous onslaught on the government. He was 68-year-old Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Roger Keyes, the man who in 1918 directed the naval raid on Zeebrugge and Ostend. He was wearing his uniform in the House for the first time. Speaking after the Prime Minister's defense of the government's action in Norway, Sir Roger exclaimed, "Everything the Prime Minister has said today has strengthened my contention that the capture of Trondheim was imperative, essential, and vital. The story of Trondheim," he said, "was a shocking one of ineptitude, which ought never to have been allowed to happen." Sir Roger said the reason he had come to the House in uniform was to speak for some officers and men of the fighting and seagoing Navy who were very unhappy. He revealed that he had offered to take full responsibility and take some old ships and attack Trondheim Fjord, but had been told that the troops were making progress and that the Navy could not risk ships which were needed in the Mediterranean because of Italian bluster. Mr. L.S. Amory, conservative, followed in another attack. He startled the House by saying, "Cromwell said to the Long Parliament, when he thought it was no longer fit to conduct the affairs of the nation, 'You have stayed too long here for any good you are doing. Depart, I say. Let us have done with you. In the name of God, go.' I've just returned from the House of Commons. In the lobby of the House, it was thought that the government of Chamberlain was safe for the present. But the speech today of Neville Chamberlain was the subdued speech of a man who felt he was fighting a battle, which would, in a few weeks, come, if not at the end of the Grand Inquisition and debate tomorrow on the Norwegian experiment, would end in a sweeping reconstruction of the government. That such a sweeping reconstruction and possible resignation of Chamberlain in the near future is regarded as inevitable was admitted in many circles. The Labour Party executive is meeting tomorrow morning to discuss the development of today's debate and their future policy. But not until shortly before the debate ends tomorrow night will they decide whether they are going to challenge the government on a vote of censure. A vote of censure is unlikely. Several members of the Labour Party wish to do this, but other members are of the opinion it would be unwise to vote against the government unless there is rebel support from inside the Conservative Party. Therefore, tonight and tomorrow, Labour MPs are and will be sounding out the Tory rebels. On Mr. Churchill's speech tomorrow will undoubtedly depend the fate of the government. He will wind up the debate for the government. Orbelish, a recently deposed Minister of War, and Lloyd George, the 77 youthful veteran leader of the last war, and Duff Cooper, will join Herbert Morrison and A.V. Alexander of the Labour Party in their attack on the government. The government will probably weather the storm tomorrow, but events are shaping for a drastic change within 6 or 8 weeks. The parliamentary drama today was pitched in a tense, deep-toned key. The eyes of the world were literally on this chamber, where amidst the life and death struggle for empire against one of the most formidable foes in history, democratic England insisted that the government explain its action, and that critics of the government have a right to say yay or nay. It was typically British not only in its devotion to debating society rules, but in its frequent understatement of expression in all the speeches delivered. The House was crowded when Neville Chamberlain entered. Its mood was revealed instantly. The Premier was greeted with a cheer from supporters of the government. The parliamentary version of the Bronx cheer came from the Labour benches, and there were shouts of resign and the man who missed the bus. Neville Chamberlain looked tired. He made a gaunt figure with mouse-gray face as he stood before the dispatch box in the center of the house. His eyes were deep sunken. His lock of white hair, that circled his forehead like a Bangor chaplet against brown, was more striking than ever. Chamberlain began slowly. He constantly moved about on a tiny spot, now removing his pince-nez glasses, now rubbing his hands together, now referring to his manuscript. The constant shifting of his body seemed to indicate the strain he was going through. The labor opposition was restive and uneasy and frequently interrupted. At one point, the speaker had to get to his feet and warn he would have to take action. His speech was a bad show even to his supporters and friends. Chamberlain is leaving the fire and oratory to Winston Churchill tomorrow. When the Prime Minister declared that he did not think the country yet realized of the extent or imminence of the threat impending against them, there were shouts from the opposition and cries, "Do you?" The Labour Party attack began with Major Attlee, leader of the Parliamentary Party, declaring the leadership of the nation was lacking in intensity, energy, and resolution. Major Attlee is no orator. His verbal duel with the Premier was a sort of duel between two katydids. I sat in the strangest gallery right next to the French ambassador in two seats from Ambassador Kennedy. The world's greatest debating society was getting down to reality. I now take you back to National Broadcast System of New York.
Thank you, Mr. Hillman, in London. Here in our newsroom in New York is Mr. H.B. Kaltenborn, noted news analyst, with a summary of the latest reports received. Mr. Carlton.
Good evening, everybody. You heard Bill Hillman's description of what happened in the House of Commons today. The address of Admiral Gaze, that veteran of Gallipoli, of Ostend, of Zeebrugge, and his challenge to the Admiralty to give him ships to enter Trondheim Harbor, and the reply, "We can't give you ships because of the situation in the Mediterranean." Never has there been greater testimony to the nuisance value of Benito Mussolini for his friend Adolf Hitler. The government, Mr. Hillman tells us, is safe, but safe for only perhaps 6 or 8 weeks when sweeping reconstruction must come. Churchill will be relied upon to save the government with oratory tomorrow. Chamberlain himself, we were told, was jeered, and his opponents cried out, "You missed the bus." That, you remember, was what he said about Hitler when the Norwegian campaign began. So that Mr. Chamberlain remains Prime Minister of Britain because his party was better than 2-1 in its majority in the House of Commons. His speech of explanation of British failure in Norway was not a strong speech. Politically, it was a clever speech. It played on the theme of national unity in the face of the enemy and exploited the popularity of Winston Churchill as against the relative unpopularity of such other members of the cabinet as Sir John Simon and Sir Samuel Hawke. Mr. Churchill is to be given more power. Mr. Chamberlain refused to admit that the country needs a different prime minister. He did admit that changes in the form of government or the functions of individuals might be needed. Perhaps the weakest part of his speech was the appeal to fear. Fear of an imminent invasion of the British Isles by a Hitler army. How a country without a navy could be expected to land and maintain an army in the British Isles, Mr. Chamberlain did not explain. But the fact that he used the threat of a Hitler invasion to silence opposition does indicate an anxious state of mind. That state of mind, which his manner, as explained to you just now by Mr. Hillman, indicated. "Beware," Mr. Chamberlain said, "of jitterings and divisions among ourselves. Presently, we may be faced by the most violent form of attacks directed against this country." Throughout the speech, there were few words of hope or confidence. The keynote was, "It might have been worse, so let's not exaggerate our defeat." He admitted Britain's loss of prestige and said that as a result of what happened in Norway, color had been added to, quote, "the false legend of German invincibility on land. We must accept that position for the moment, but we need not help our enemies by making it worse, unquote. This is the Prime Minister of the great British Empire telling the House of Commons and the world that for the present at least, German invincibility in land operations stands demonstrated. He characterizes that invincibility as a false legend, but confesses that events in Norway have given it color and says that for the present, it must be accepted. Mr. Chamberlain indicated that there will be no attempt to retrieve British prestige in southern Norway. The campaign there is at an end. It was undertaken in response to the most urgent appeals from the Norwegians for an attack on Trondheim at all costs. The reason they gave for insisting on the recapture of Trondheim is that it was a place essential for the government and the king. The failure to take it, according to Mr. Chamberlain, was due to lack of airfields in Norway and the rapid arrival of German reinforcements. The British leader lauded France for showing what he called remarkable steadiness. It is true that there has been much less criticism of the Norwegian disaster in France than in England, but there are three good reasons for this. Reason number one is the French censor. He usually does a much neater job than the British censor in reducing anti-government comment. Reason number two is the fact that the French Chamber of Deputies is on vacation. If the Chamber of Deputies were debating the Norwegian debacle, a little of the steadiness to which Mr. Chamberlain refers might disappear. Reason number three is that the French were not involved to nearly the same extent as the British. They sent only a few men and a few ships, and their prestige was not at stake in the operation. Throughout his speech, the Prime Minister was subjected to heckling and to jeers, and for the first time in his career, that particular thing has happened. At one point, he sat down until order was restored. The sharpest attack was, as has been indicated, that of Admiral Gaze and that of Clement K. Attlee, the Labour leader. Sir Archibald Sinclair, Liberal leader, called for a smaller war cabinet and more vigorous action. More foresight, he concluded, more energy, and more ruthless will to victory will be required. And cheers echoed from one side of the House of Commons to the other in response to that particular statement. The boldest words uttered today did not come from Mr. Chamberlain, but from King Haakon of Norway. The king of that country issued a proclamation which said, "In northern Norway, we still hold strong positions, and from here, with help now being planned, we shall succeed in reconquering the rest of the country. We have reason to believe that the conditions of superiority in the air for the Germans, which forced the Allied Norwegian retreat, will soon be changed. It was not war, but murder and arson, which the Germans have been practicing in Norway, but the morale of our people remains unshaken." Thus spoke the King of Norway. Tonight, the Italian press is ridiculing Mr. Chamberlain. Chamberlain in power is a guarantee that the conduct of the war on the French and British side will remain weak, tardy, and inconclusive. And the Nazi press, of course, echoes that kind of comment. And tonight, the Nazi press is shouting its concern over possible developments in the Mediterranean, which leads the Dutch to prepare for developments elsewhere. They've tightened their defense precautions, called more classes of marine reserves to the colors. And tonight, all telephone and teletype communication with other countries are suspended by the Dutch government. This is the fourth time the Dutch have taken similar precautions. For the moment, it only means that something may happen, not that something will happen. For as matters stand, there is no added immediate threat. Good night.
Thank you, Mr. Kaltenborn. Tomorrow evening at this time, Miss Dorothy Thompson, noted journalist, will report from Paris. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.